I'm Laura Murphy-Oates, and this is The Full Story. By now, you've probably seen the surreal interview between President Donald Trump and reporter Jonathan Swan for Axios. It goes like this. Swan makes his way into the West Wing, and the two men sit down on tiny chairs while a shaky handheld camera moves between them.
Mr. President, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
We appreciate you taking the time. Good. And we appreciate your commitment to answer our questions.
Sure. Really,
the interview plays out almost like a political satire.
You know, there are those that say, you can test too much. You do know that.
Who says that?
Oh, just read the manuals, read the books.
Manuals?
Read the
what
books.
Manuals?
Read the books.
What books?
So, as one cast member of Veep, a TV show and political satire, said, this scene would have been rewritten because a president being this stupid is unrealistic.
South Korea.
Jonathan, we didn't even have a test. When I took over, we didn't even have a test. Now, in all fairness,
why would you have a test?
There was no test.
The virus didn't
exist.
How would you have a test?
President Trump loves dominating the news cycle, but it's hard to imagine he's taking much pleasure from the trending hashtag Trump is a laughingstock.
Here's one right here, United States. You take the number of cases.
Okay.
Now look, we're last. Meaning we're first.
Last? I don't know what we're first in.
Is it what? Take a look. Again, it's cases.
Okay.
And the interview also underlines something alarming. 5 months into this pandemic, the president does not have COVID-19 under control.
Right now, I think it's under control. I'll tell you what.
How? 1,000 Americans are dying a day.
They are dying. That's true. It is what it is.
Today, how did Donald Trump get the United States pandemic response so wrong? It's Monday, the 10th of August.
I want to start with a study that's been making the rounds recently.
Mithali Rao is a senior producer for The Guardian's international news podcast, Today in Focus, where this episode first aired. She spoke to Ed Pilkington, the chief reporter for The Guardian US.
It came out back in October, and it looked at how prepared countries around the world were for a potential pandemic. The US actually came in number one on this index, meaning it was judged to be the most prepared country in the world. What made it seem that the US was in such good shape?
To understand that, you have to go back a tiny bit to 2014 and the Ebola crisis in West Africa, which America was drawn into very quickly.
This morning, the door-to-door investigation begins. Health officials, including a crew from the Centers for Disease Control, now in Dallas, in search of anyone who may have come in contact with the first patient diagnosed with Ebola in the United States.
I've been spending quite a bit of my time talking to people who were at the center of the attempt to respond to Ebola, and they all said the same thing, that the experience of going through Ebola was truly terrifying. In the end, it never actually really hit home in America. But the experience of seeing what a virus could do if it was uncontrolled was so sort of daunting and awesome for the officials and the scientists and the public health experts who were involved in that effort, that they came out of it determined never to go into another crisis like that without being prepared. And that was true also of Barack Obama.
There may and likely will come a time in which we have both an airborne disease that is deadly. And in order for us to deal with that effectively, we have to put in place an infrastructure, not just here at home, but globally, that allows us to see it quickly, isolate it quickly, respond to it quickly. How do you argue with that? That is not a partisan issue.
He brought scientists into the White House. He set up a special unit within the National Security Council, specifically focused on what would happen if there was a pandemic. They prepared a 69-page dossier or a sort of manual of what to do were a pandemic to hit. They really put a lot of effort into thinking about two things in particular. One, logistics, like what did you need to prepare hospitals, to prepare frontline workers, what protective equipment did you need, all that kind of thing. And how would you get enough testing were there to be a pandemic? And the second thing they put a lot of time into thinking about was messaging, because at the end of the day, controlling a virus without a vaccine is all about human behavior. So I think that's what won them the number one position in that scorecard, which was published only a few months ago. You have to pinch yourself.
That sounds very far away from where we are now. Just by the numbers, it's kind of hard to take in just how out of control things have gotten in the U.S. The official number of cases is now about 5 million. That's more than a quarter of all the cases in the world. And the death toll in the U.S. is now past 150,000. Can you give us a sense of the scale of what's going on?
It's just America is a disaster zone and has been since the pandemic erupted. I think that point is underlined by foreign comparison. South Korea and the U.S. recorded their first case of coronavirus on exactly the same day, January the 20th. South Korea has had a total of 14,000 confirmed cases. Now, South Korea has a sixth of the population of the U.S. If you times 14,000 by six, that is the amount of cases the U.S. has had in one day just this month. In one single day? Yeah.
Wow. Obviously, we can't talk about how the coronavirus is spreading across America without talking about President Trump. You mentioned President Obama there speaking in 2014 about pandemic preparedness. But President Trump has taken a very different approach to a lot of things in his presidency. Even before coronavirus hit, President Trump was making cuts to public health agencies. What did he do?
President Trump's agenda has been guided by literally doing the opposite to what Obama did. In the transition period when Trump was president-elect, a week before Trump was inaugurated, the Obama team laid out on the table for the White House their guidelines to what to do with the pandemic. It was based on all those things that we discussed, the 69-page manual and all the rest of it. And they said to them, look, this is serious. It could happen any time. What do they do? Well, they completely disregarded the 69-page manual. Trump disbanded the unit within the National Security Council that had been set up to deal with, specifically to deal with pandemics.
Some of the people we cut, they haven't been used for many, many years. And if we ever need them, we can get them very quickly. And rather than spending the money, and I'm a business person, I don't like having thousands of people around when you don't need them. When we need them, we can get them back very quickly.
This was all even before the pandemic hit. Once the virus arrived, how would you describe his approach?
He continued what he'd already begun earlier, which was a willful and relentless undermining. The CDC has a reputation, or had the reputation, of being the world's foremost public health agency. I think it's fair to say that in normal times, you would expect the CDC to be giving daily briefings in which scientists directly communicate with the American people and advise them. The CDC has not been heard of since maybe the first few days of the pandemic. Kind of literal silence from them. And when they have put forward recommendations, Trump tried to stop the recommendations being published. And when they came out, he actively kind of poo-pooed them, said they were exaggerating the scale of the problem.
The CDC is advising the use of non-medical cloth face covering, but this is voluntary. I don't think I'm going to be doing it.
In the same way that he's sidelined and undermined the CDC institutionally, the same thing has happened, I think, on an individual level. The figure that comes to mind is Dr. Anthony Fauci. You'll know him from his gravelly voice.
You know, I would say between 100 and 200,000 cases, but I don't want to be held to that because deaths. I mean, we're going to have millions of cases.
I think most people within the scientific and public health community respect him deeply for the job he's done, which has been an impossible one of trying to hold Trump, you know, to the data and the science.
Dr. Fauci, as was explained yesterday, there has been some promise with hydroxychloroquine, this potential therapy for people who are infected with coronavirus. Is there any evidence to suggest that, as with malaria, it might be used as a prophylaxis against COVID-19?
No, the answer is no. And the evidence that you're talking about, John, is anecdotal evidence.
President, on those therapies.
I think without seeing too much, I'm
probably more of a fan of that than maybe than anybody. Mm-hmm. May work, may not work. I feel good about it. That's all it is, just a feeling. I'm a smart guy. I feel good about it.
Fauci sort of slowly vanished. And the counter story to the disappearance of Fauci is that Trump has surrounded himself with yes people. Now, again, this is nothing new. It's familiar from his first 3 years in government. He surrounds himself with people who tell him what he already wants to hear. And in this case, he surrounded himself with people who say that he's doing a fantastic job on coronavirus. Everything's going marvelously well. America is leading the world. Three things that are the direct, diametric opposite to the truth. And it's interesting, Dr. Deborah Birx, a respected scientist in her own right, but she has become Trump's go-to person. And she presents him with modeling and with selective data that puts everything in a pretty rosy light, to the dismay of other scientists who think that she is exacerbating the problem by failing to challenge Trump. There was that famous moment where she was sitting on the sidelines while Trump came up with perhaps his most glorious conspiracy theory that we've heard so far, which was the idea that you could inject disinfectant.
By injection inside or almost a cleaning, because you see it gets on the lungs and it does a tremendous number of the lungs, so it'd be interesting to check that. So that you're going to have to...
And then he also had some weird idea about injecting ultraviolet light into the body, and this would protect you against coronavirus.
Pretty powerful. I would like you to speak to the medical doctors to see if there's any way that you can apply light and heat to cure. You know, if you could, and maybe you can.
I mean, I think to this day, no one quite knows where that came from. And just completely bewildered by that. The camera panned out from Trump making this extraordinary statement across to Birx, and there she was on the side of the room. I think she was kind of looking down and trying not to give any response, but what she certainly didn't do was challenge it.
Deborah, have you ever heard of that, the heat and the light relative to certain viruses? Yes, but relative to this virus?
Not as a treatment. I mean, certainly fever is a good thing when you have a fever. It helps your body respond. But not as I've not seen heat or light.
I think it's a great thing to look at. I mean, you know. Okay.
You might think as a central scientist at the top of the most powerful country in the world's response to this terrible pandemic, you might think she might have said something.
And not only is President Trump surrounding himself with people willing to agree with him, it also seems that some of his advisors are happy to actively supply him with numbers selected to make the U.S. response to the coronavirus look better than it really is. Earlier this week, he had that remarkable interview with Jonathan Swan at Axios.
And if you look at death,
started to go up again.
One. Well, right here, the United States is lowest in numerous categories. We're lower than the world.
Lower than
we're
the
lower
world?
Lower than what is that? Europe.
In what? Look. In what?
Take a look. Right here. Here's case death.
Oh, you're doing death as a proportion of cases. I'm talking about death as a proportion of population. That's where the U.S. is really bad.
Well,
much worse than South Korea, Germany, etc.
You can't do that.
And not long before that, he had a similar interaction on Fox News.
And hello again from Fox News in Washington. Today from the White House.
How did that unfold?
The interviewer, Chris Wallace, who is a sort of acceptable face of Fox News, if you like, an extremely good journalist, he challenged Trump about his record on coronavirus.
Sir, we have the seventh highest mortality rate in the world. Our mortality rate is higher than Brazil. It's higher than Russia. And the European Union has us on a travel ban.
Yeah, I think what we'll do...
And Trump said, no, you're wrong. We have the best mortality rate in the world.
When you talk about mortality rates, I think it's the opposite. I think we have one of the lowest mortality rates in the world.
At which point Chris Wallace said, with respect, sir, no, you don't. And he then turned to his aides and said, hand me the graph.
Give me the mortality rate. Kaylee's right here.
I heard we had one of the lowest, maybe the lowest mortality rate anywhere in the world. You have the numbers, please? Because I heard we had the best mortality rate.
And he was handed by his aides a piece of paper with a graph on it that showed the U.S. at the top.
Number one low mortality rate. I hope you show the scenario because it shows what fake news is all about.
Okay, go ahead. I don't think I'm fake news, but okay. We'll put our stats on.
When Fox News Sunday then interrogated that graph, it found that the figures are being selectively chosen so that countries with a much better mortality rate than America were kept off and countries with a much worse one were put on. I thought that terribly telling. I think that's a little insight into what's happening generally.
You've made the point that one of the most important elements for an effective public health response in a pandemic is messaging, letting people know what the risk is and what they should do. But President Trump hasn't really stayed on message at all, has he?
Trump's messaging from the very beginning has been a combination of denial.
It'll go away. We're doing very well and we've done a fantastic job. It will go away. Just stay calm. It's going to go away. 1.4 million tests on board next week and 5 million within a month. I doubt we'll need anywhere near that.
Incredible inconsistency.
You're confident you can surpass 5 million tests per day? Is that?
Oh, well, we're going to be there very soon. I didn't say 5 million. Somebody said 5 million. I think it might have been the Harvard report. There was a report from Harvard, and they said 5 million. Well, we will be there, but I didn't say it.
And the other thing he's done is to embrace sort of maverick theories rather than the scientific advice he's being given. So we're now 7 months into the pandemic, and it's still happening. So about a week ago, there was a huge sigh of relief from the public health community when Trump finally came out and said masks were an important public health tool and should be worn by the American people. It wasn't an order, but it was a recommendation. And
this was very much an about-face, right?
An about-face from what he had said before, where he'd been very dismissive of mask wearing in a very political sort of way. Just a few days after that, you know, we wake up and there's a retweet from Trump of a video.
Hello, I'm Dr. Stella Emanuel. I'm a primary care physician.
A group of doctors who had given a sort of presentation in Washington in which they said not only that masks should not be worn, they were actually a public health risk, but that hydroxychloroquine, which is a malarial treatment that Trump has touted many, many times, was also a cure for coronavirus, an actual cure.
This virus has a cure. It is called hydroxychloroquine, zinc, and Zithromax. I know you people want to talk about masks. Hello? You don't need masks. There is a cure.
Now, all major health institutions around the world have found that hydroxychloroquine is certainly not a cure, but nor is it a treatment. It doesn't seem to have any positive impact on treating COVID-19 and actually can be life-threatening for some people with various conditions. It should be noted that one of the doctors in that group happens to be an advocate of the theory that alien DNA is contained in some medications in the US. Hmm. And she similarly believes in brace yourself with this one, demon semen.
Next, how all of this might affect President Trump's chances of re-election.
So, Ed, we've talked about Trump's leadership style, his messaging, his disregard for science, which have all, without a doubt, played a part in how Americans have responded to this pandemic. But if we look at what he's actually done in terms of specific policies, there really hasn't been a unified national response. He hasn't imposed a nationwide lockdown, and so individual states have had to decide whether to lock down and when. And when governors have locked down their states, the president has been very quick to urge them to reopen.
When are you going to open the state up? No, seriously. You're going to miss your whole, you know, you do 40 million people in tourism, and you have a governor that won't let you open up. What's she doing? You ought to get the state open, governor. Open your state.
His messaging is almost always focused on the economy. What do you think is driving his response to this pandemic?
As time passes, you know, I think the answer to your question gets clearer and clearer, and that is Trump is motivated in how he deals with this pandemic, not by the nonpartisan need to protect life and to protect the economy of this country, but by the motivation of getting reelected in November. And I think in his worldview, he was going to go into an election in which his top ticket for getting back into the White House would be what he kept saying was this glorious economy. In fact, what that meant was, you know, soaring stock market values, which for most Americans means nothing because they don't have any stocks and shares. But in his mind, he split off the economy from fighting the virus, which I think is an epic mistake. The only way to get the economy back up is to open safely. Therefore, the economy and the virus are hand in glove. They are the same challenge. In the end, it's destroyed the economy. It's been worse for the economy because states have tried to reopen quickly to get the economy back up. And all that's happened is the virus has had a field day. It's munched its way right across the country. And it's now forced states to close down again. And that is kind of arguably worse because it's created a huge uncertainty, which makes it extremely difficult for business to operate.
We touched there on the approaches different states' governors have taken in the absence of anything like a nationally coordinated policy, which I think does bring up an important point about the unique challenges of trying to manage a pandemic in the United States. There are federal laws that govern the entire country, but then individual states have their own laws, which means things get very complicated in a situation like this. Isn't it arguable that any president would have had a very difficult time dealing with this?
Yes, I think that is fair. You know, it's a huge country, 330 million people, and very, very decentralized. And a lot of power is devolved to state level. If another president had been in the White House, they would have found it extremely difficult. And they would have had struggles with states and with logistics and all the things that we've seen happen. But having said that, the way he's handled it, he's exacerbated the natural problems that were there rather than try and overcome them. The job of a federal government in this disaster is to help the entire country deal with the crisis appropriate to each part of the country. But what Trump has done is to wash his hands of the pandemic. And so what we've seen is states go their own way. It's a bit like herding cats. They've just scattered, gone completely different ways. Individual states desperate for diagnostic testing equipment, for ventilators, for PPE, protective gear for their health workers. They began competing with each other. They began bidding against each other to try and get scarce resources, of course, pushing up the prices. And meanwhile, the sort of Trump administration stood back and allowed this all to happen. Meanwhile, the virus doesn't see borders. The virus doesn't stop and show its passport at the border between a Republican state entering into Democratic New York. And this is, again, perfect for the virus. It's perfect for the virus. It's just like, okay, thanks, guys. I'll spread away quite merrily.
We also have the issue of a growing polarization in American politics. And this is something that we've seen even before President Trump took office. How has that shaped the country's response to the pandemic?
Trump has set a template and it's kind of been replicated at state level right across the country. And you've had the country divide in two. And we see this very clearly with the issue of masks.
Your second question was? I couldn't hear you. Can you take it up? Because I cannot hear you.
I'll just speak louder, sir.
Oh, okay, good. You want to be politically correct. Go ahead.
No, sir. I just want to wear the mask.
Go ahead.
Again, for me, it's been one of those pinch yourself moments. How does a little square of cloth become a culture war? You know, you can kind of understand why abortion might be a subject of heated debate. But a piece of cloth? But it has literally become a culture war. Their fights have broken out in many different states when people refuse to wear masks indoors.
And you think you have the right to take your mask off to get everyone else sick. Meanwhile, you just threatened to f***ing cough on me during a global pandemic. Are you for real? Is that funny?
It's ridiculous. There's so much research that says that we actually are in danger of having this mask. I'm breathing my own CO2. Do you understand that?
We don't cover our face in America. They don't control us. We're Americans.
The right-wing Trump supporters have adopted the non-wearing of masks almost as a flag. They say that to be forced to wear a mask is an abnegation of their freedom. They've kind of expressed it in a similar way to people talking about the Second Amendment and guns in America, particularly conservatives saying, you know, they must have the freedom to bear arms. Similarly, they must have the freedom not to wear a mask. So, and of course, without a vaccine, masks are one of the very few things that you have at your disposal to try and control this virus. So when it becomes an issue of politics, this is really, really serious, and it's actually life-threatening.
And it seems almost hard to believe right now, but America is supposed to have a presidential election in just 3 months. Where do we go from here?
We've just heard Trump say in a tweet that maybe we should postpone the election because of the fraud that's going to happen from voting from home during the pandemic. Now, you know, we know that he can't legally do that, but it's going to put the cat among the pigeons, and it's an example of the sort of uncertainty of what we're heading into. Having said that, an interesting thing does seem to be taking shape. And I'm going to say this with enormous trepidation because I, like so many others, had my fingers burned in 2016 when Hillary Clinton was going to win the election. We all knew that until we didn't know that. We're seeing that Joe Biden, the Obama's former vice president, is taking a pretty commanding lead in the polls, of more than 10 points in sort of nationwide polls, but more substantively, he's showing a lead even in the key swing states, such as the three that Trump famously won in 2016 that kind of gave him the White House, which was Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin. Very significantly, I think, is when you drill down into the polls and you see people who are surveyed asked, how do they think Trump is handling the pandemic, it's a very interesting thing's happened. At the beginning of the pandemic, more than 50% of Americans approved of the way he was handling it. And now that figure's fallen to 38% with about 60% disapproving. So, you know, it's not reading too much into it, I think, to think that Trump's hardcore supporters, that, you know, the red-capped MAGA supporter, is sticking with him even through this current catastrophe of cases and deaths of coronavirus, but that pretty much everyone else is starting to think, wow, you know, this is not looking good. I think a lot of Americans are becoming very scared about this.
Ed, you've been living in the United States for more than a dozen years, covering national politics, among other things. How has it felt to live through this pandemic in the U.S.?
Well, I mean, the thing that strikes me in terms of my relationship with America is a sort of sense of despair almost. And I pick it up a lot from the scientists and the public health experts. They've seen the United States go from the pinnacle of science. You know, you think back to JFK beginning the push for the moon landings. And now it's the laughingstock of the scientific world. And, you know, to some extent, I feel the same. I came to America when I was 4 because my father, who's a medical researcher, he came here to carry out research. And through my father's eyes, I saw this country as a seat of science, a seat of fact-based reason and of sort of logical government. And I've watched that as it collapsed around me. The way I come to see it is I think it's the clearest example any of us are likely to get in our lifetimes of what government and governance means. If you think of Trump, you know, in the past, he's proven to be like a Teflon figure. But here we have a different situation. And I think the scales are falling off people's eyes. They're seeing what government and political leadership actually means. And it boils down to a question of life and death. I don't think I'm being melodramatic by saying that. You know, we now have 150,000 deaths in America. It's 300 in South Korea. So you're starting to hear a growing number of scientists and academics ask the question, how many of those 150,000 deaths, and that figure will rise to way beyond 200,000 by the end of this year, what proportion of that figure are people who died needlessly? There's a small step from there to ask, how many American lives have been lost as a result of Trump's mishandling of this pandemic? And that's the frame that I've come to see it through. And I think it looks like that's the frame that an increasing number of Americans are coming to see it through as well, as we get closer and closer to this hugely important election.
Ed Pilkington, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's it for today. Thanks to Ed Pilkington. If you want to read more of his reporting, head to theguardian.com. This episode first aired on the Today in Focus podcast from the Guardian team in London. If you liked it, you can subscribe by searching for Today in Focus in all the right places. This episode was produced by Joshua Kelly, with sound design by Axel Cocoutier, additional production by Joe Koning. The executive producers of Today in Focus are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. Okay, catch you tomorrow.